All right, this week we read the study of Vayechi, finished Sefer Breishis, and at the heart of Vayechi is, of course, the brachos of Yaakov Avinu. So the Torah says at the very end of the brachos, in the Parak Memtes, Pasuk Chav Ches, Kol Eila Shivtei Yisrael Shnei Masar, these are the 12 tribes of Israel, V'zos Asher Diber Lohem Avihem, this is what their father said to them, by Baruch Hosam, and he blessed them, each person with his own particular blessing, that's what Yaakov blessed them with. So what in fact are your blessings? This we've discussed in a number of contexts because we see this a few times in the Torah. Avram blesses his sons, Yitzchak blesses Yaakov, Yaakov blesses his sons here. Bilam, in fact, attempts to curse the Jewish people, but he winds up blessing them as well. Moshe blesses the Jewish people at the end of the Torah. So what, in fact, are blessings? Blessings are not, certainly in this context of Yaakov Avinu and Moshe, and in fact, Bilam. They're not just flowery good wishes. Not that we mind getting flowery good wishes, too. But the brachos here are prophetic revelations of the essential character of each of the tribes. And that's why it's so important. Yaakov, that's how the parsha begins, that Yaakov assembles them in order to convey to them this prophecy. Gather and I'll tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. Meaning, what is going to be the tribal character, the manner in which every tribe will express its unique contribution to the Jewish people. As our verse says very well, we're not the monolithic people. I include anybody who talks to a Jew. We're not a monolithic people. We're in fact a very diverse people. We're diverse, ideally, in 12 different ways. Each tribe having its own character. The unifying element, of course, being the Torah, being Avodah Hashem, and that common origin. So what Yaakov did here was reveal or expose each tribe's character, where they're going to be, how they're going to contribute in the best sense, what midos they have to refine or channel properly in the worst scenarios, like Reuven or Shimon and Levi, who were each had their own direction, which left to its own devices would be destructive. But how they could channel that midah properly for the benefit of everyone. And certainly those other tribes, what midos they could exploit or use as a catalyst for the national good. That, in fact, is what Yaakov was blessing them here. And that's why it's so important. So I want to focus on one. And that's those are the blessings of Yehuda, which begin in Perek Memtes Pasuk Ches. The longest brachos are those given to Yehuda and to Yosef, because they emerge as the two leading tribes. Levi, of course, is also a very important tribe, but his role is limited to the Beis HaMikdash, in a sense, whereas Yehuda and Yosef have much broader national roles, but primarily Yehuda. What's Yehuda's role? Malchus Yisrael. Yehuda is royalty, the monarchy. He's the leader of Israel, and therefore, it's extremely important to know the qualities that Yaakov discovered in Yehuda, in essence revealed in Malchus Yisrael, because those are the qualities that carry down to us today. And in fact, I hope if I can to shed some light on Jewish affairs, because we see really two tracks that exist in the Jewish world, tracks of leadership. And a lot of what we're enduring these days, these years, and these past decades are revealed in these psukim, which is how it's meant to be. So what is unique about Yehuda? What are the qualities of leadership that Yaakov perceived and decided to publicize? So the Torah says, Yehuda, ato yoducha achecha. Yehuda, all your brothers will acknowledge you. All your brothers will acknowledge you. So Rashi says that, of course, we recognize that Reuven and Shimon and Levi did not receive what we would traditionally call blessings in the colloquial sense, more like curses or criticisms.
So when that happened, Rashi notes, Lefi Shochiach es Harishon beKantorim, Yaakov began almost a diatribe against the first three brothers. So Hisli Yehuda Lasug LaCharov, Yehuda started to disappear. You know, it's like the teacher goes in alphabetical order and has nothing good to say about children with A and B. So C starts to hide under his desk. That was Yehuda. And Yehuda also had skeletons in the closet. Shelo Yochichen on Masay Tamar. You know, if he's criticizing Reuven for what Reuven did several times with Bilhah and with Yosef, and he's criticizing Shimon and Levi with Shechem, Yehuda's Masay Tamar. So Yaakov called out to him. Ukro Yaakov b'divrei ritzui. He said to him something which would appease him. Yehuda lo ata kemosam. You're not like them. You're different. In fact, the first measure of leadership that inheres in Yehuda is ato yoducha achecha. All your brothers will acknowledge you as a leader. So in fact, when does that happen? Wow. Imagine if there was a Jewish leader that everybody acknowledged. It hasn't happened in my lifetime. Hasn't happened several thousand years, as I recall. So Rashi notes, it was talking to Bimei David. In the time of David HaMelech, who was the first monarch from the tribe of Yehuda. And afterwards, the monarchy flowed through Yehuda. But this is not the norm. It's not the norm. And why it's not the norm, certainly not today, we'll discuss. Yoducha means something else as well, the Medrash says. Yoducha also means to praise. Hodu Lashem Kitov. Hilel and Chasda. Praise. Yehuda ata yoducha achecha. See, the highest form of leadership is when everyone acknowledges the leader and everyone praises the leader. Most of life is not like that. I mean, truth be told, we're in a terrible period generally the last 40 years when it comes to leadership, as we've noted a few times. Ever since the 60s, leaders are always criticized, but ever since the 60s, universally, globally, it's been just an age of ridicule of authority with all the attendant consequences on the stability of society. And it's not just American society, Israeli society, it's really across the world. If you go, certainly any democracy, the leader is always lampooned, ridiculed on a constant basis. It's no different here than anywhere. Like the Times magazine yesterday, an article about Ukraine. A democracy a year old already there, where they can get rid of the prime minister and the subject of taunts and satire. It's just the way it is. There was a time, certainly when the monarchs of Europe were more respected, that leadership generally was respected, but not anymore. And that could have something to do with the quality of leaders also. It's always possible, but I think human nature doesn't change that much, and there's no saying that Elizabeth I was any greater than George Bush II. Nonetheless, that is the reality that we deal with. But the highest form of leadership is always atayoducha hecha, where your brothers, your peers, not only acknowledge your leadership, and don't strive to undermine it, but yoducha in terms of praise as well. So that we have to... We have to understand why that doesn't exist anymore. Yadcha be'oref oivecha. Your hand is on the neck of your enemy. So Rashi here says this is Bimei David. In the days of David and Shlomo, that is when our security reached its zenith. It was a time of tremendous physical and military strength and security of the Jewish people. Now this is because vulnerability threatens the ability of Klal Yisrael to do our real work in the world, which is Avodas Hashem, which is Talmud Torah, which is to be an Or LaGoyim, to serve God, to do the mitzvos, to study Torah, to be a light unto the nations. It's not the same as we look at it today. It's not only that insecurity or vulnerability threatens our existence. If that's all there is to it, then that security becomes an obsession that leaves people wondering, people across the world, what is it exactly that they represent? You know, why is it important that Jews survive? I think certainly the last few years, as Israel's narrative has become less and less compelling, it's a question that's more and more on the world's mind. You know, why do they have the right to have these checkpoints? They say, well, the Arabs are trying to kill them. Yeah, but why are they trying to kill them? And as we keep peeling back the layers of the onion, and it almost becomes self-justifying, because the argument is never made, well, there's a specific purpose in the existence of the Jewish people, in the Jewish people having a national life, and that purpose is ABC, to be an Orla Goyim, to be an exemplar of morality to the rest of the world. See, that argument is never made. And because it's never made, the only argument that's ever made is the Holocaust, we have to protect ourselves, or there are too many wars, or it's this, but whatever it is, but the argument doesn't stand on its own, can't stand on its own. Everybody in the world wants security. No person in the world wants to be subject to terror. And no person in the world wants to have their home lost either. So if you're not going to assert the uniqueness of Klal Yisrael and our role in the world, then Yodcha Ba'oref Oivecha becomes an albatross. It doesn't become a blessing. And that's the problem. Yodcha Ba'oref Oivecha is not self-justifying. And it's not an end in itself. The fact that we're militarily ascendant when Yehuda's Malchus reaches its apex is as a means to something, not an end in itself. It's a means to allow the beauty of the life of Torah to emerge. If that argument's not being made, then the security argument falls on deaf ears. And that's one of the problems. You know, if you saw a new commercial, Israel's tourism commercial. You saw that. Beaches, theaters, shows, right? What else was there? Right, at Yerushalayim. Who knew? Right, who knew? So that's the problem in a nutshell. All right, you wouldn't know if there's supposed to be the land of the Jews, the land of the Torah. You wouldn't know it. All right, you want a nice beach? Go to Aruba. You want ruins? Go to Cozumel. Right. If you're not going to make a unique argument for Klal Yisrael, so then the world wonders. Let's see, the Arabs can't go from their home in Gaza to their home in Hebron, so these people should have a nice beach? Or they should do Taichi? It doesn't make any sense. Right, it doesn't make any sense. So that's the problem. Yodcha ba'aref oivecha means that your hand's on the neck of your enemies, and there's more than that. It's because there's a purpose behind your life. There's a reason. There's a critical reason why Jews have to survive. And further, and this is really the measure of the leader, it's not only Yoducha Hecha, Yodcha Ba'aref Oivecha, Yishtachavu Lecha B'nei Avicha. Your father's sons will bow down to you, will prostrate themselves before you. What does that mean? It means that this is really the greatest mark of leadership, that both your enemies will be subdued, that is to say, of a good foreign policy, and Yishtachavu Lecha B'nei Avicha, your brothers will bow down to you, means you have an effective domestic policy. That is very rare in the world. That's very rare in the world. To have your oivim under your thumb, and at the same time, b'nei avicha, your brethren, your fellow citizens, very content, that's a dream. And we see this time and again in the world. But the Nitziv makes this point, that you rarely have both. You have leaders who focus on domestic policy or foreign policy. And there's always not both. It's very hard to do both, but that's the ideal. You see, the leaders who focus on domestic policy, then foreign crises seem to brew unnoticed until they erupt. You don't have to look very far for that. Who was that? Bill Clinton. He focused on domestic policy, and the disaster came to pass after he left office. Conversely, you have other presidents who focus on foreign policy. Bush is forced into that position now, but most presidents enjoy foreign policy much more than domestic policy, because it's easier to fight an enemy than to rectify an intractable problem. Very difficult. And of course you have the phenomenon also of people, of leaders using foreign crises
in order to divert attention from domestic unrest. That's true in America. It's true certainly amongst dictators also. In the Arab world, it's always a staple when there's turmoil to find some problem with the Jews, either to blame it on or to find some unrest. Hitler, for Yimach Shmo, of course, was like that. But it's true in democracies also. You rally people when you're able to find some foreign foe. It's much harder to rally people when you want to talk about welfare reform or revamping Social Security. People don't get excited about that unless it's your interest group, your agenda that's being attacked. The good leader is both. The good leader knows how to keep his hand on his enemy's neck. At the same time, that on the home front, everything is not only peaceful, but subdued. Hello. I hope I'm not that boring. So that's the first thing. That's the first element. Gur Aryeh Yehuda. Now Yaakov says Yehuda will be a Gur Aryeh, a lion cub. What's a lion cub? Why not just a lion? Because a lion cub is always young. A cub is fresh, vibrant. Rashi says here, Gur Aryeh Yehuda al David Nisnabe. B'tchila gur, first David was a lion cub. Yashol melech aleinu, atayisa amotzi v'amevius Yisrael. When Shaul was the king, so David became one of his leading combatants. He wasn't the chief of staff, but he was the most prominent soldier. Of course, after the incident with Goliath, ulavasof aryeh. But at the end, he became a lion. Kishem lichu aleihem, when they made David the king. A king, see, Rashi says, starts off as a gur, and becomes an aryeh. A leader has to be perceived as experienced and seasoned, and at the same time as always open to new ideas, always looking at existing problems from a fresh perspective. You know, the old bitter joke about the rabbinate goes, the ideal rabbi is 30 years old and has 25 years experience. I think it's the reverse. He's 25 years old, has 30 years experience. That's what people look for. But that's Gur Aryeh. The Medrash says that he has to have the Gevura Shel Ari, the courage, the strength of a lion, and the Chutzpah Shel Gurav, the Chutzpah of the cub. All right? The lion, the older person is more experienced. He's more seasoned. He knows better to react rationally to circumstances that arise. On the other hand, that sometimes leads to inaction too. The more you weigh every type of possibility, every type of consequence of any action, then the more you're led into a policy of paralysis by analysis, they call it. You analyze so much that you can't decide what to do. And you end up doing nothing, and then problems fester. You need the chutzpah of the gur. Sometimes the one who just acts says, let's do it. We have to because we have to do something. We have to change the dynamic because it's an unhealthy dynamic. On the other hand, you want the Aryeh also. That's Yehuda. Gur Aryeh Yehuda. He has that quality of leadership. As well as what's probably most important, Miteref B'ni Aliso. That you arose, you ascended Aliso Miteref B'ni from the prey of my son. The prey meaning of Yosef, and this is Yaakov's allusion to what happened to Yosef. Miteref, Rashi says, Mima shechashaticho b'tarof taraf Yosef chayoro acholosu. That from what you were suspected of killing Yosef, of having him torn apart, from that you arose. V'zeh Yehuda shenim shalaryeh. So from that terror, from that attempted destruction, attempted devourment of Yosef, my son, you, Bini, Alisa, you ascended. Silaktos atzmacha. You removed yourself from them. V'amarta, and you said, Ma betza kinaroga sochinu. What gain is there in killing our brother? Yehuda said to the others. Or, Rashi, the other point, Barigas Tamar, Shehodosh Sodka Mimeni, when Tamar was led out for execution, and you, Yehuda, confessed and said, no, she's right. I was wrong. She's right. And of course, as we know, we discussed this in the past, Tamar could have been executed at the end of it. And had Yehuda said nothing, no one would know the difference. No. He said, you're right. It's my shame. I'm wrong. And that really, we discussed in the past, what qualified him for leadership, the ability to confess a mistake. But here, Yaakov focused on something else. Miterf b'ni Olisa. Everyone wanted to kill Yosef, and you said no. Mabetza kinar gesochinu. Silaktos atzmacha. What is Rashi telling us? Reuven wasn't there. He left, yeah. He left. He didn't know what to do. V'ono v'ani, ono aniva. And assume, where am I going to go? So he like went off for a walk. So he went back to his father, but he went, he disappeared. In fact, he disappeared when Yosef was sold. Reuven also wasn't there. He came back and said, where's Yosef? So that actually was a failure of leadership. Rather than assert himself, he decided to not deal with it, which also sometimes leaders do. I don't want to think about it and go away. And things become worse. Enough of it. It's a crisis. I know. It's a crisis. That's why he's held as culpable as the others for the sale. He's not, his role is not dismissed. But Yehuda had the most difficult task of all. Literally, to stand against the mob and say no. Silaktos atzmacha. Miterf b'ni Olisa. From that horrible parsha, Olisa, you ascended. One measure of leadership is the ability to stand against others. Not to go with the rov. Not to go with the majority. Yeah. Right.
Right.
So that goes back to that story. They thought they were justified in doing
it.
But Yehuda said they could accomplish the same end by selling him, not by killing him. That's right. Yes. That's true. They all felt that. The most powerful desire was to kill Yosef once and for all. And you said you would have protested. Now remember, he's protesting one against nine now. One against ten, actually. One against nine. And against his older brothers, Reuben, Shimon, and Levi. Or Reuben's not there, against Shimon and Levi. See, he stopped it. He went against the rov. Now, that's the toughest job of a leader, not to follow the masses. You know, in a democracy, we think the rov is always right. It's not true. The rov may be koveya. The rov may be able to dictate their will to the minority. It doesn't make them right. Matter of fact, we have the same klal in Torah. Achei rabim lahatos. So you follow the rov on the Sanhedrin too. Doesn't mean they're right. But you have to follow them. They could be wrong too. You see, a Sanhedrin can make a mistake based on a rov. We won't say the rov is right. The rov could be wrong too. But you have to follow the rov. You have to follow for procedural reasons. The leader, though, he doesn't follow the rov for procedural reasons. He has to do what he thinks is right in his own mind, and that's where he broke away. He broke away from them and was able to tell them no. And that's not difficult. It's very hard, especially you're talking about not strangers. You're talking about his brothers, and to know that whatever he does, like Ofer just said, would be criticized. Could have brought him back, could have stopped them, could have killed them, could have sold them. He had all these choices. Whatever he does is not right. Whatever he does can offend somebody. That's the measure of leadership that Yaakov recognizes here. And I bought a sign when I was away last month that I have hanging in my office now that I have occasion to access almost every time I pick up the phone and talk to someone. It says, I look at it constantly, it says, for every action, there's an equal and opposite criticism. Yes.
Emerge as a leader, but because of this Yehuda
I never saw it interpreted pejoratively, because in fact, you know, it's a what if question. What if they hadn't sold Yosef and they would have lived happily ever after in Eretz Canaan, never gone out to Egypt? Would Yehuda have been the tribe of monarchy? The Torah is the Torah. So the fact is, we're going down to Egypt, and it took place a certain way, and then people's character emerges as a result of that. We deal with that. So it's hard to speculate along those lines. Right. Well, again, not necessarily, because like Ofer said, he left because of they turned on him because he, you know, they said to him, which is a very hollow argument, of course. Very convenient argument for them. Yeah, sure. Had you told us, we would listen to you. Because he told us to sell him. He didn't let us kill him. But whatever you would say, we'd listen to. Could be that's not true. Right? Leader has to know also that he can't do things that will alienate everybody. So if he would have said to them, no, let's just bring him back to Dad and forget it. Bygones be bygones. They may have killed him also. So you have to know exactly what to do along the lines. But that's such a complicated issue. We've discussed it so many times. But you can't say, you know, what if it didn't happen, because everything depends on that it did happen. If it didn't happen, everything's different. Yeah. So what does that make Yehuda then? So Yaakov continues. Kara ravatz karyeh uchalavi miyikimenu. He becomes like a crouching lion. A crouching lion that's poised to strike, but yet doesn't have to. And that's the highest madrig of leadership, both certainly foreign on foreign affairs, but even domestic, that there is a deterrent factor, that people know he's so powerful, and he's poised to act, he's not hesitant, that there's no reason to provoke him. And that's Yehuda, Kara Ravatz Karyeh. He's a gur, but he's crouching like a lion, and so therefore the enemies of the Jewish people are really intimidated. They are complacent in Israel's ascendancy because they recognize the greatness of Yehuda. They all fear the crouching lion, but the crouching lion doesn't have to fight. And that's the great benefit of the crouching lion. With this, we come to the one of the beautiful psukim in the Torah, one of the most eternal psukim of the eternal Torah. Lo yoso shevet mi Yehuda u'mechalkek mi bein raglav. The scepter shall never depart from Yehuda, nor the mechokek, nor the scholar from amongst his descendants. And he's a leader both in as a monarch and as the head of as the Torah, what Plato later called the philosopher king. Lo yoso shevet mi Yehuda, shevet in terms of his royalty, and mechokek mi bein raglov in terms of his spiritual leadership as well. It's a combination of political and spiritual leadership. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh comes, Shiloh is Mashiach. It's the first reference in the Torah to the Melech HaMashiach. Yaakov says, until the Mashiach comes, v'lo yikhasamim. And then, all nations will be assembled, will submit themselves to the reign of Yehuda, or Malchus Yehuda. Rashi says, lo yosef shevet Yehuda, one with these gifts, always has to lead, or the nation suffers. And that's why monarchy in Israel is hereditary. It's not subject to popular vote. Rashi says it's midavid veilach. This explains why there are other kings. Moshe was a king, Shevet Levi, Yeshua, Shaul. Only when David became the king, that's when Malchus Yehuda became entrenched in the Jewish people. And Rashi seems to imply forever, not just when we're in Israel. Elu Rashi Golia Shibibavel, Sherodim Eson B'Shevet, Shemumum Alpi Malchus. Rashi says it applies also to the exilarchs in Bavel. Note, they're not even in the land of Israel. The exilarchs were the heads of the Jewish people, the religious and political heads, certainly the political heads, in Bavel. The institution lasted 14 centuries. Till Rav Haigon died in 1039 of the Common Era. That's a pretty long run for Malchus David. Lo yoso shevet mi Yehuda u'mechokek mi bein raglov tamidim elu nesi Eretz Yisrael. These are the nesiim, the princes, like Rabbi Yehuda or Hillel, Rabbi Gamliel, also descendants of David. So political leadership in Israel always has to represent the confluence of political and spiritual greatness. And if it's not, something suffers. All right? Something suffers. What's the clearest suffering that we have besides today? The clear suffering is the Malchus Hashmonaim, which the Ramban here attacks. He says that's where the Hashmonaim were punished. They were all worthy people at the beginning, but their dynasty, he said, was illicit, because they were Shevet Levi, they were Kohanim, and the Kohanim were not allowed to rule. So the Ramban says right here, that's why the Malchus of the Hashmonaim had to fail. It had to fail. There's not even any survivor from Malchus Hashmonaim. One of the most fascinating things. Already before the time of the Churban, there was one descendant of the Hashmonaim, a woman who killed herself. I think she was married to Herod, and she killed herself. And she said, and they said after, anyone who says that he's a descendant of the Hashmonaim is really an Eved. So the whole family was eliminated less than 200 years after, a little over 200 years after the story of Hanukkah. Because you don't want any rival in terms of Malchus Yisrael existing. It has to be Yehuda. If it's the Kohanim, then it already represents a distortion of what the perfected monarchy is. So the monarchy of any other tribe, including the Hashmonaim, is not ideal and would lead to a permanent corruption of the ideal system. Certainly if the Kohanim lead, because they're supposed to be in the Mikdash, they have a different role altogether, but in fact any other tribe. Yeah, that's not leadership, that's Talmud Torah. Well, again, that's the philosophy of the king. As the king can't just be a politician. The king has to be a Gadol B'Torah too. Keep in mind, the king carries around with him a Sefer Torah at all times.
Right, but you're saying that a lot of the
Nesiim,
I guess, whatever, came from him and
great. No. The Nesiim. The Nesiim are all the B'nai David, right? Nesiim. Sure, why not? That's the philosophy of the king. That's Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. The national leader is also the great Talmud Chacham. Plain. There's nothing plain about being a scholar. Tremendous. Fantastic. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Keep in mind, the Sanhedrin, right, the Sanhedrin functions also as a national legislature in the sense that when the issues arose, they had to decide too. Yeah. By the way, you know, it's not well known because unfortunately we don't study it today and the Gaim don't care. But a king couldn't go to war without the approval of Sanhedrin. There was a tremendous system of checks and balances under Torah law. You know, I've studied years ago. You see, it's a brilliant system. I saw an article, it was a law review article, I remember when I was in law school, that someone wrote, tracing the roots of the Constitution to the Bible. Really a brilliant piece. But it's a shame that Jews don't know it. There's a tremendous system of checks and balances. The king was an absolute monarch. He could put anyone to death. And yet the Sanhedrin had the right to depose the king also. They felt he was a Rasha. All right? Both. The king? See, then it becomes a practical issue. That, you know, I always remind myself of, I think it was the early years, late 1790s. I think it may have been Hamilton of Burr said this about John Marshall. He said, the Chief Justice has spoken, now let him go enforce it. So let him go enforce it is always the issue. You know, if the king is Achav, you can get a very nice Sanhedrin filled with plain and not-so-plain scholars. Go tell him. That's the problem. But when everything is functioning well, the system really has these balances between tribe of Levi and Sanhedrin. And Sanhedrin also was a meritocracy of knowledge. You know, Gemara Sanhedrin is quite clear on this. If they're trying a case, and they couldn't have had to add more Dayanim, it's a capital case of 23, and it was split 11-11, and they didn't know, one person said, I don't know, or two people said that, so they added people from the ranks, and it was, you sat based on a hierarchy. All right, how great you were in Chochmah, how well respected you were. It was a semicircle, which the closer you were to the front, the greater Talmid Chacham you are. And they would just keep like using the chest, just moving people up depending on their Chachma, on their worthiness. We should try that in shul, by the way. You know, see people. You know where they do that? In the big Belzer Beis Medrash. Beis Medrash in Yerushalayim. It seats, you know, 5,000-6,000 people. I mean, when I visited there 2 years ago, there was an empty seat, the fourth row. And the bearer of the seat had died, and his son wanted the seat, and the Eder came down. Not yet. They have to see, you know, me for me. And if yeshivas also? Right. That's right. Right. So the Maharal explained, because everyone's troubled, well, Yosef Shevim Yehuda, the fact is, before David, there were no Malchi Yehuda. And after, you know, Vaigam, there's also no Malchi Yehuda. So what are we talking about? Maharal said, when we're Re'uyim L'Malchus, when the Jewish people are worthy of monarchy, then it has to be Yehuda. If we're not worthy of monarchy, then we have other tzaras. But it always returns. No. Shaul was not. And we'll get to that in a moment. But Shaul was not. Shaul was Ben Yamin, Ben Rachel. All right, hold on to the thought. We'll get back to that. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until Malchus HaMashiach. Rashi says, Ad ki yavo Shiloh, Melech HaMashiach Shem Melucha Shiloh. Real monarchy belongs to him. He will be the... I don't want to say the ultimate expression of the philosopher king, but as the Rambam seems to imply, K'David Aviv, he'll be on the level of David HaMelech, his father, his ancestor. That's when the monarchy will return. So Rashi's examples, interestingly enough, are all exile examples. Well, when we are not dominant in the land of Israel, we are not sovereign, both in Bavel and the Nisim, who by and large operated under Roman rule. So you see, Malchus, according to Rashi, exists even post-biblical times. There's always a concept. Find a Yehuda, Ben Yehuda, to be the Melech, to be the ruler. Ramban says, no, it's only talking about we're in Eretz Yisrael, only talking about monarchy, and hence the problems with the Chashmonaim. Now this, Ad ki yavo Shiloh, v'lo yikach samim. And then when that happens, all nations, asif ha'samim, all nations will assemble and turn to Israel and its leaders for guidance, how to handle their affairs. We will be the leading counselors to all nations of the world. That's Yemos HaMashiach. Now, by the way, it's not completely far-fetched, because already for the last 200 years, in many countries in the world, the top counselors, certainly the economic advisors, were very often Jews. So you see that... You see that phenomenon in existence. It was always one of the more humorous asides of Israel's first 50 years. How is it that Jews advise every country on their economies, and the Jewish state's economy is a basket case? How could that be? But it's also part of life. Oh, that's true. Yishtach v'lcha b'nei avicha. That's very hot. That's a good point. That's very true. What else? So now, two interesting psukim that almost seem to pale after we speak of Yemos HaMashiach, but nonetheless, Osri la gefeni ro, he ties his donkey to a vine, v'lasareka b'ni asono, and a foal to the vine branch. Ki beis bayayin levusho, he launders, he washes his garments in wine, gives a nice reddish tinge to everything that you wear. Uvedaman avim suso, and his robe in the blood of grapes. Chachlili einayim miyayin, his eyes are red from wine. Ulaven shinayim mechalov, and his teeth are white from milk. What's this? What's this vision of Yehuda? The donkey to the vine, the foal to the branch. So this is how the Mepharshim explain it. Rashi says, "Nisnabel eretz Yehuda shetahim moshechas yain kimayan." It's a reference to the land of Yehuda, where the wine will flow like a spring. That is to say, with everything else, the Yehuda's monarchy gives rise to tremendous, a great era of prosperity. Everyone is, the land is fruitful, the land is productive, prosperous. That's what the tribe of Yehuda is. So you shouldn't think, as people do today also, there's some type of inconsistency between spiritual greatness and material success. On the contrary, the ideal is that we're prosperous servants of God. That's the ideal. If we haven't realized that ideal, it means something is wrong somewhere. Either we're too materialistic, or not spiritual enough. But something is wrong if the system doesn't work out. But Sfarno says here, by the way, that it's a reference to Mashiach also. Asila Gefeni Ro, that he ties his vine to a donkey. As we know, Mashiach arrives on a donkey as a sign of humility. What's key based by Yain Levusho? He washes his garments in wine. Who would want to do that? Nobody I know. It's just a reference to wine in abundance. You see, wine's a precious commodity. It costs $10 a bottle. How many gallons do you use laundering clothing? I don't know, but dozens, apparently. A person who will use expensive wine to launder garments, it means the wine is flowing very freely, very inexpensively. And that's a reference to the prosperity that takes place. Not only that, he's chachlili einayim miyayin, he's red-eyed from wine. Meaning he's what does that mean? Doesn't sound good, but it means he's happy. Because wine, yayin is samach levav enosh. Wine brings a person to joy also. Not too much. Too much brings a person to frivolity and licentiousness. But in the right amount, it's chachlili einayim miyayin, he's happy. Ulaven shinayim echalav. What does that mean? White tooth for milk. What is that? I commenced this last night. Mara says in the Ksubas, Daf Kufir Aleph Amud Beis, that Libun Shinayim, the teeth become white from milk. The Gemara says, Tov Hamal Ben Shinayim Lachavero Yosami Mashkeo Cholov. Better is the person who shows the whites of his teeth to a friend than even give him milk. Meaning what? A smile is worth more than a little milk sometimes. A smile, which is a sign of psychological affiliation to another person. A bonding is more important to the recipient than even a little handout. Better to show the whites of your teeth to someone than, you can give them something. I mentioned the last night in reference to Stanley Amzel, Ol V'Shalom. That's Libun Shinayim. So it means we not only see prosperity gives rise to something else. What is that? Competitiveness, ambition, dog against dog, a constant struggle for greater slices of the pie, each person trying to get what the other has. That's what prosperity causes also. Mariah, America's the very most prosperous country in the world, and it's the most competitive country also. And I wouldn't say necessarily people are the happiest in America. Everybody's always fighting, zero-sum game. No one wants to lose that on anything. No one wants to waive any right. It's a very litigious society. That's what happens when you have so much. When you have very little, there's nothing to fight over. So you're not very litigious. But America's a very litigious society. Not so the ideal Jewish society. It's chachlili einayim miyayin. Everybody's happy. Prosperous. Ish tachas gafno, ish tachas teinoso. Everybody has his own vine tree, his own fig. I have, you have, also good. You're happy, I'm happy. And not only happy, but friendly. Leven shinai mechalav. None of the dog-eat-dog phenomena that you have often in capitalistic societies, and none of the poverty and misery that you find in the communist societies. But it's a perfect combination of happiness and friendship, as well as spiritual and political leadership, with no problems from enemies. Korah shochav karyeh. Israel's perceived as a crouching tiger. Crouching lion. Poised to attack if anyone tries to interfere with our the Jewish dream. Sounds like a dream, right? Sounds like a fantasy, this world. Is it? Well, it's the ideal. That is the ideal, and it would be remiss if the Torah did not mention the ideal. But what's the reality? I don't want to say the reality is none of these things, but the reality is, in fact, an intermediate stage from point A to point C. And that intermediate stage is really Yosef.
because the bracha of Yosef is as long as the bracha of Yehuda. They each share five psukim. And Yosef is charged with a specific task, as we recognize. So Yehuda presides over a nation of spiritual greatness and prosperity and peace. But Yosef gets us to that point. As if Yehuda's on the mountaintop, but Yosef is the one who's charged with taking us up the mountain. Yosef is the preparatory stage. That's why Yehoshua is a Ben Rachel. Benjamin, yes, his brother, but he's Ben Rachel, not Ben Lael. And that's why, I'm sorry, Yehoshua is a Ben Yosef. He's from Ephraim. He's Ben Yosef, literally Ben Yosef, the first manik, the conqueror of the land, the one who's going to initially till the soil of the Jewish state. And Shaul is from Binyamin, who's also Ben Rachel, Yosef's brother. So that's the Hechsher Mitzvah almost. That's the intermediate, the preparatory stage for the ascendancy of Malchus Yisrael. And of course, that's also the role of Mashiach ben Yosef, the two Mashiachim. Mashiach ben Yosef is also the one who paves the road to Mashiach ben Yehuda, Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef is the one who creates the material infrastructure which Yehuda can then perfect in terms of Torah. No, Yosef's the mashpir. See, Yosef is the one who sustains, who nourishes all of Egypt, who brings the brothers down. Yosef is always a bridge. He's a transitional figure. That's why Yosef is always associated with struggles. Always with struggles. He's trying to sanctify the material. That's Yosef. He tries to sanctify the material.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're in Golos. It's true, they're in Golos. It's all true. But they're still in Golos. Look at Yehuda's name. What's Yehuda's name? As the Chazal say. Yehuda's name is Yud-Tei-Vav-Kei. It's with Dalid. Duh, Yehuda. Dalid, because Yehuda takes the Shem Hashem and propagates it to the Dalid Kanfos Aretz, the four corners of the earth. That's Yehuda's role. Yehuda, like I said before, is the mountaintop. He's the zenith of our existence. But Yosef is the one who gets us here. And that's his name. Yosef, what does that mean? Adding. Yosef is ever increasing. It's building level upon level, as opposed to Yehuda, which is a sense of triumph. So that's why, in fact, you see it perfectly and beautifully played out in their lives. The days of Yosef, even the Torahs who read the last few weeks, are filled with challenges, with feuds, with internal strife, with our inability to agree on anything. That's today. Today, what's that? That's the era of Yosef. The era of Yosef is nobody recognizes his leadership. On the contrary, what happened to Yosef? They got rid of him. It was a coup. They sold him into slavery. Yehuda, atoyoducha achecha. Everybody acknowledges you. Yosef, the brother sold you, and even at the end of the seder today, barely want to come forward and reconcile with you. Because there is no unity. It's a superficial unity. That's the difference. You see in the ear of Yosef, by the way, the ear of Yosef, you know, the transitional era, the bridge to Yehuda's era, there's no leader today who has a happy ending. An unbelievable thing. There's no leader, certainly of Israel, that has a happy ending. It's very difficult to get a handle on the material world and make everybody satisfied. It's not impossible. Don't say it's impossible, because Mashiach does it. But in our day, certainly, it's very difficult to get a handle on the material world, the world of politics, because the range of issues are so broad. So Yosef tries and strives and struggles, ever increasing. Yosef, to add, to supplement, to increase, each day, each year, trying for a little more. As opposed to Yehuda. What's Mashiach ben Yehuda? Mashiach ben David? How does he come? Osula Gefen Iro, what does the Navi say? Ani v'rochev al chamor. He rides the donkey. What's a chamor? Chomer, material. The Mashiach ben David is the one who's able to ride the material.
meaning he dominates it, is not dominated by it. He's able to conquer it, so it diffuses amongst the Jewish people in its proper order. That's Mashiach ben Yehuda. But the one who develops the Chamor, that's Yosef. Yosef is the one who develops the Chomer in Mitzrayim, in the early years of the Jewish state with Yeshua and Shaul until the monarchy came. All those are bridge years. What's that? Yeah, that's right. Exactly. He was the one who provided them sustenance. That's exactly what it is. Yeah, he provided sustenance. Who provided the spiritual element? Ve'es Yehuda shalach lefon of Goshen leharos. Yaakov sent Yehuda to provide a spiritual home, to build a base Talmud. But Yosef is the master of the material. But Yosef begins the process of fusing the spiritual with the material. That culmination only comes in the days of Yehuda. That's why... You want to say something, George? Yeah. Right. That's right. Oh, very good. Very good. So we're really in the world of Yosef, all right? Except for one thing. How do we know we can't ever lose sight of the ideal? Because we're called Yehudim. It's a beautiful medrash on this sedra. Atayaducha achecha, Yehuda. Yehuda, atayaducha achecha. That we always define ourselves by the ideal. So medrash says here, B'shim ben Yochai, also lived in a terrible time. He said, what does it mean, atayaducha achecha? You call Achecha Nikra'in al Shmecha. All your brothers will be called after your name. Ein Adam Omer. A person never says, Reuveni Ana, Shimoni Ana. I'm from Reuven, I'm from Shimon. Elo Yehudi Ana. Everybody says, I'm a Yehudi, I'm a Jew, a descendant of Yehuda. Because we define ourselves by the ideal. We, in fact, define ourselves by our destiny. That's what it is. You know, in a sense, not a Navi, but we just look at the era in which we're living, and it seems, of course, certainly in our relation to leaders and the philosophical foundation of the State of Israel as it exists now, it's in a Yosef mode. It's a Yosef mode. Struggling, trying to work out the proper parameters of the spiritual identity of the state and the material identity of the state, sometimes succeeding, other times failing abjectly, terribly, but one element of the society trying to move us towards a Yehuda-like existence, another element of society trying to forget the Torah entirely, just immerse ourselves in an existence of Chomer, as indicated by the tourism commercial. That's the struggle of the era of Yosef. That's why there's no acceptance of any leader today, like there's no acceptance of Yosef. That's why we still look forward to that day of Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh V'lo Yikasamim, the day of Yod Chabarif Aivecho, Yishtach V'lucha B'nei Mecho, unity amongst Klal Yisrael, admiration of the nations of the world, a desire to emulate the state of the Jews on the part of the other nations of the world. That's the destiny of Israel. That's why we're Yehudim. Yes. Exactly.
What does that reflect?
That's material greatness. That's material greatness. Absolutely.
Where does Yehuda show, other than the fact that Yehuda showed leadership in terms of Tamar and in terms of Yosef?
Right.
Where do we see the beginnings of the spiritual leadership?
1 second. You're missing one of the crucial elements that we discussed, I think it was 3 years ago. Where have you been?
My brain has deteriorated.
That Yehuda was the one who said to his father in Miketz, entrust Binyamin to me. Anochi ervenu miyadi tevakshenu. I'll be his guarantor.
The Olam Haba.
Yaakov saw Reuven as flighty. He saw Yehuda as grounded in reason, as offering a plan, and a real plan tying his future, his destiny to that plan. Reuven was just a politician. Yehuda. So you had now 3 case of leadership. What's the fourth?
No, but I'm talking about spiritual leadership.
Yeah, well, yes. No, no, no. You can't have one without the other in the Jewish world. You can't have a great political leader who's not a spiritual leader. Something has to go wrong. That's clear. Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda was the one who took charge. Reuben was there too. Levi was there too. He took charge to try to save Binyamin.
But these are all examples of him taking charge in a very physical, material way. I'm talking about where do we see the beginnings of this?
Well, you have in Tamar's case, Tzad Kamimeni. But it's all related. Binyamin's case is also spiritual, absolutely. But then you see, Yaakov sent him down. It's Yehuda Shalach Lefanov. Lahoris, Yehuda sent to Goshen. Yes.
We could make it some headroom nowadays if every rabbi said that 70 people would be our leaders. Is that true?
Well, actually, they did start a Sanhedrin last year. It's now a year and a half old. I think Odin Steinsaltz was appointed the Rosh Sanhedrin, but it's kept sort of quiet because the official entities, it's a very volatile time in Israel. It's always volatile. The official entities don't care for it because it's perceived as a negation of the existing rabbinical court system as well as the secular court system. So that's why it's kept under wraps.
Because if 70 rabbis...
They met the last time they met was, I think, November, December. Yeah, I know they are. I don't know all the names, but there are many Rosh Yeshiva Rabbanim. Steinsaltz was pointed out based in.
And who else?
The names, some of the Rosh Yeshiva I knew, and I don't remember the names offhand.
And they
but,
were accepted by all sections of the society?
No, not at all. We're talking the era of Yosef, not Yehuda.
Yeah. So the point I'm making is that among spiritual leaders, we can't have absolute and have been. If I was a rabbi, I could not sleep at night for the fact that we cannot agree. I'm not saying every rabbi can make a decision.
And now that you're not a rabbi, you do sleep at night.
Okay,
there you go.
But the truth, what I'm saying is, unless it's Sanhedrin, where we show we have such unity and such lack of importance to ourselves, and that we think for the greater good of
actually, the Sanhedrin.
If we make a Sanhedrin,
right,
people can be a candidate. We'll never get to that other point.
Right. The Sanhedrin, as appointed, has a nice cross section of people, but it's operating in a vacuum. It doesn't have universal acceptance because there are many entrenched interests, which is all part of the volatility of the times. That's what we're dealing with here. That's the era of Yosef.
Yeah, but it's also that there are rabbis that will not accept this rabbi, will not accept that rabbi.
Tell me about it.
No, but it has nothing to do with you.
Some of them are in B'nai Shurin.
Right.